the energy transition progresses, households are becoming active participants in an increasingly decentralized and flexible energy system. But what does this mean in practice? How can consumers bring technologies such as EVs, heat pumps, solar, and storage together to reduce costs, improve energy resilience, and make the most of their own generation? To answer these questions, I had a chat with Andrew Clint, CEO of My Energy, about the evolution of the home energy ecosystem. Andrew discusses what is driving household electrification and why consumers are increasingly motivated by the tangible benefits of low energy bills and greater energy independence. We also look at the role of policy in accelerating adoption, the challenges of coordinating multiple home energy technologies, and how smart assets could help deliver much-needed flexibility to the grid. I'm Pamela Larg, and this is the Energy Transitions Podcast. Andrew, thank you so much for joining me today. We're talking about how energy is changing, energy perspectives around the grid and how homes are potentially changing into these energy ecosystems. So firstly, welcome. Secondly, how is household electrification changing and accelerating? And what technologies are driving that change?
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting question. And thank you very much for having me on your podcast. So I work for a company called My Energy based in the UK. And we were founded just about 10 years ago by Lee Sutton and Jordan Brodson. And Lee is himself an electrical engineer. And he used to be a solar installer back in the relatively early days of rooftop solar in the UK. And one of his clients one day asked him, what can I do with all of this energy that I'm now generating from my solar panels? And why can't I put this energy into my EV? And why can't I power some other devices like my water heating in my house from this energy? And so even back then, it was a question that people were asking, what is this electrification journey really going to mean for me and my home? And on the back of those questions, Lee sat at home over a few nights, and he was thinking about this challenge that he had been given. And he then came up with two products, which we still sell later generations of these products today. One is called Eddy, and that was actually his first product, and that's a solar diverter for heating hot water. And then the other one, Zappy, which is the world's first solar-compatible EV charger. And that is really has been the cornerstone of the business all the way through to today. But I think if we look more generally, now that these sort of technologies like solar PV and electric vehicles have moved from early adopters into much more mainstream, we still see in different markets that we operate in, we see different entry points for consumers thinking about electrifying their home. We operate in UK, some European countries, and Australia. The Australian market, that was all about solar PV. That was the entry point. Much more recently, it's become a lot more about EVs because the cost of petrol and diesel have gone up so much following the Iran war that the percentage of households now getting an EV in Australia has shot through the roof. If we looked at the UK, it was much more about EV. So that would be typically the first entry point that households would take into electrifying. Solar still remains a relatively small proportion of households in the UK. Look at Netherlands as another example. That's again been much more about rooftop solar and is now becoming very much about batteries. So I think consumers have obviously come into this journey from various different angles. But as soon as you get an EV or you get solar, then you start to think about what tariff do I need to optimize my energy costs. Then you start to think about the other energy assets that you can add to your home to make your journey cheaper in a lot of cases. Because a lot of people are now doing this because it cuts your costs. They're not doing it so much around climate change or around being a real passionate zealot for going zero carbon in your home. It's become a lot more about cost and cost saving. And we estimate that homes today with a full suite of solar panels, battery storage, and EV, and solar water heating can save around about £1,800 a year off their electricity bill. So that's getting towards zero bills sort of territory, which I think is a real incentive and real driver for customers to start to adopt more and more of this technology. I think that the other angle of your question is probably about how these assets become part of the energy grid. And that's, I think, an interesting area to unpick because it's still very early stage in consumers' understanding of the energy assets they put into their home.
That really is a great segue to my next question, because we've come a long way from consumers perhaps viewing these individual technologies like, oh, I want to put solar panels on my roof, or I just want to get an EV. There is really a drive to kind of combine technologies, get more than one, because consumers, as you say, are starting to see, wow, there is a real tangible cost benefit at the end of the day, which is so needed this time. Like you mentioned, the Iran war, gas prices going up, and you actually want some homegrown renewable energy that is cheaper and more reliable. So are we seeing that mindset change in consumers?
Yes, I think we're beginning to. We've seen, certainly since the Iran war, we've seen a significant increase in interest in battery storage, really across all of the markets that we operate in. And I think that's driven by two effects. One of those is with a battery, you can save significant amounts on your energy bill because you can obviously access low-cost overnight energy and then use that during the day when your peak demand is. And we would say with a battery on its own, without any solar, without any other energy assets, you can save £300, £400 a year through energy arbitrage. But then the other one is energy resilience. And we're seeing a lot more people are now asking about home backup from a battery system because people are obviously getting concerned about your potential attacks onto the energy system itself. Quite recently in the UK, it was reported in the press that there was a cyber attack on a relatively small peak gas power plant. And I think that starts to then put it into people's minds that actually the energy system itself could be vulnerable to some sort of external attack. Both of those are driving customers towards thinking about how they can make their home more resilient and how they can ultimately become a lot more self-sufficient in terms of energy generation.
Would you say that there's also certain policies that are coming into play, and I'm talking specifically in the UK, that are also driving the change in behavior and the adoption of, for example, solar? I mean, recently the UK government made plug-in solar panels legal. That will also surely go a long way in terms of democratizing household energy generation.
The role of policy cannot be underestimated in all of this. If I look at this, a couple of these other, I will come back to UK in a minute, but if I look at just a couple of those other territories that I spoke about, Australia at the moment has got a very significant battery grant scheme running. And that is driving a huge uptake in a number of batteries that have been installed in homes across Australia. And they came to that decision because they had a choice between either upgrade the grid with significant billions of Australian dollars of investment required. And that was because they had now distributed power generation to all of the rooftop solar. So the grid couldn't cope. So rather than doing that, they decided to incentivize homeowners to install batteries. And if you look at Netherlands, which I also mentioned before, they used to have a net metering scheme. That net metering scheme has come to an end. So all of the people that had installed solar on their roofs and were benefiting from net metering are now having to think about how can I self-consume all of the solar generation myself or store it in a battery, which is why that's now driving battery systems. So regulations across all of these markets, while we're still at the relatively early stage of the energy transition, is vitally important. And in the UK, there's quite a few positive things happening in the UK around regulations. As you said, the balcony solar or the plug-in solar is now allowed to be sold in the UK and plugged in the UK. And I think that will, because now you'll be able to go into a supermarket and pick up a solar panel with your weekly grocery shopping. So I think that's definitely going to make a lot of people really start to get into that journey of generating their own power. Then you've got to think about is they're going to be very low wattage in terms of what they can generate compared to what the household needs. So it's not like you're going to be able to run your whole house off a plug-in solar panel. But I think people with, you know, a few hundred pounds of disposable income will definitely go down that route. And then that will be a stepping stone into the much broader ecosystem, probably starting then with thinking about rooftop solar once they've got into the idea of generating for themselves. And there's various other things in the UK as well around regulations, the Future Home Standard, which is looking at the energy assets that should be put into new homes that get built, and the Warm Home Scheme, which is incentivizing heat pump installs and potentially also battery storage in homes, retrofits into homes. So there's quite a lot of legislation and incentives which are coming through, which are certainly going to help people on this journey.
Yeah, for me, it's really interesting to see the UK as an example because, you know, you mentioned that the entry point was more along sort of electric vehicle lines, perhaps less with solar. So perhaps this will actually really encourage the adoption of solar. But also, I think perhaps, again, the whole psychology around generating your own electricity and what that means and how you can save. You know, so yes, it starts with policy, but it seems that the UK is doing that quite effectively and really bringing it home, literally, what this could mean.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I always like to think about the fact that until very recently, most consumers just thought about their energy as the monthly direct debit, the monthly bill. And that was it. And you didn't think about it beyond that. And if you look at the push that the UK government had a few years ago for tariff switching to try and get consumers to engage more and choose a different tariff to get the best possible price. And a very small percentage of people ever bothered to switch. So there wasn't that kind of proactive engagement from consumers. But now we're moving to this world where as soon as you get an EV, as I said before, you then want to be thinking about, well, I want a smart tariff because I want to make sure that I'm benefiting from cheap overnight electricity to charge my EV because I can see really tangible savings from doing that. And then you can then start adding the other assets and you think, well, I want a battery tariff now and I want a heat pump tariff and I want to be able to sell my surplus solar back to the grid through a feed-in tariff. So you're starting to get much more engaged consumers. And that's before we even talk about flexibility markets and how consumers engage in the flexibility market, which is another whole area of complexity potential for consumers. I think the other thing to think about with all of these assets in the home is that they need to work together. And that's certainly when I talk to people who've moved into a new home, for example, and they've got solar from one supplier and they've possibly got a heat pump from a different supplier and they've got an EV charger from a different supplier. And house builders will want to keep their costs as low as possible when they install these assets. So frequently they're from different suppliers wherever they can get the lowest cost and to be able to comply with the regulations. And then the householder moves in and none of the assets talk to each other. So the householder is then left with a very confusing situation about how do they actually optimize all of these different assets in the home. It's at that point that I think consumers go from the enthusiasm factor of I can do this, I can self-generate, to suddenly realizing this all feels a bit complicated and now I've got to figure out, yeah, how's all this going to work together? And one of the big reliefs actually from my energy, go all the way back to Lee Sutton's original vision, is that we create assets that work seamlessly together, integrate with smart tariffs so that you can optimize at the home level, not at the individual asset level, because we take care of those individual assets. So I think that's because you said the interest in consumer behavior. I think one of the key consumer behavior points to get consumers to continue to adopt this is that home level optimization, not just asset level optimization.
Indeed. I think as a consumer, you want things to be smart and simple. If we can get that right, fantastic. And I think that brings me to my next question rather nicely, which is, of course, the complexity around all of these devices, especially if you start taking flexibility markets into account, vehicle to grid, things start getting a little bit complex and certainly perhaps out of the wheelhouse of many consumers. So what are the impacts then? I mean, obviously, we've got people generating electricity, you know, perhaps plugging in their EVs, powering back up the grid. How do you manage that? What are the complexities associated with that?
Yeah, well, I suppose a couple of real life examples, I guess, would be around EVs and smart tariffs, because you can potentially control your EV charging from the car itself or from the app that came with the car, or you can control it through your energy supplier's app, or you can control it through the app that came with the EV charger. So you've got possibly three different ways that you can schedule charging. And that can immediately become very confusing for consumers, especially if they have just signed up to a smart tariff previously. So that they've maybe been scheduling their charging using the app that came with the EV charger. So the more intelligent EV chargers going forward will enable you to, as I said, integrate with the smart tariff and then control it all through one app. And so that consumers have only got to go to one place to actually get that controlled. The level of complexity that you can have if you're trying to control multiple different devices in the home, all through different apps. One of the classic problems is if you've got a battery and you've been charging up your battery during the day from your solar, as soon as you come home and plug your EV in, it's quite likely your battery is going to drain into your EV, which is probably not what you intended. But if the battery is not aware of the other assets in the home and how it should behave, then that's what will happen. Rather than optimizing whether you're taking cheap energy from the grid or you're using your own self-generated solar, you will suddenly find that all you've done is taken it from one battery which sits on the side of the house, you put it into another battery in your car, then you haven't probably got the benefit you thought you were going to get. So that's why having an ecosystem that works together is so critical for these homes going forward.
Andrew, what I'd like to find out from you is obviously to ensure that our grids are ready for the future, can accommodate renewables and, you know, decarbonize, but we can still have this decentralized element. How do you balance that? Do you think that with the increase in decentralized energy, we'll need less investment in the grid?
Well, probably yes and no, probably the answer to that question. I think so there's interesting local level problems that arise as soon as you start to put lots of rooftop solar onto the grid. And actually, if I'm allowed to mention a rival podcast, if you look at the one that Lee Sutton, our founder, did with eFix, then you'll see him talking there about the voltage challenges that can arise on the grids from rooftop solar. So if you think about the likely increase in the volume of rooftop solar that's going to go into the UK market, we are going to see voltage spikes at a local level, typically between the home and the transformer. That is going to lead to particularly smart appliances in the home potentially tripping out, and consumers therefore getting a worse experience. And that can't be controlled by the energy distribution companies, because it's beyond the transformers, so they can't manage that voltage fluctuation at that level. So what that really says is that you need to have a mechanism to balance at that really local level, and that mechanism typically would be batteries. The things that we would argue at MyEnergy is that if you're going to do a rooftop solar install, you should really be putting a battery in at the same time anyway, because then you can do that local balancing rather than risking putting too much power back into the grid at the local level. When you look nationally, it is definitely, as we all know, the grid was not designed for lots of distributed generation, which is what we're getting today. It was designed for large power stations, typically large loads in industrial areas and smaller loads in residential areas. And what we're now doing is we're generating all over the place and trying to put all of that back into the grid, often at times of day when demand is not as high and it needs balancing. And that's where the consumer-led flexibility roadmap, which the UK, I think, has done a really good job actually of publishing that consumer-led flexibility roadmap. That's where that comes into play. And that is where the increasing requirements for all of these assets to be smart, so they can be turned down at peak times and potentially turned up when we've got too much renewable generation, so too much wind or too much solar, together with an increase in the volume of distributed battery storage, and ensuring that all of that lot works together and all of that can respond to grid commands. That is where we're going to have to go to avoid, or to not to fully avoid, but to offset some of the grid investment that would otherwise be required.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I think when we're looking to the future, my question to you is, what does this, let's say 5-10 years from now, a future home ecosystem, energy ecosystem look like? And what do we actually need to implement to get there? And I'm talking sort of on a practical level, policy level, you know, and maybe let's start with the UK, because I would like to do a bit of a regional comparison. I'm quite interested in Australia as well, but let's start with the UK.
Yeah, so I think that's the whole home ecosystem. I think in the UK, it will still start with an EV in the majority of cases, because it's the majority of people in the UK have a car, and a large percentage will switch to an EV for their next vehicle. So I think that will still be the entry point. So you will end up with a smart EV charger. Obviously, as long as you have a driveway where you can have an EV charger, because that's a whole different story around cross-pavement charging, etc. And then typically the next asset that I think people will start to realize that a battery, even without solar, is the next thing that you want to get. And if you think about the install, it's relatively simple. So you're not talking about having roofers to come and put solar panels on your roof. You're not talking about any kind of plumbing aspects as you would have with a heat pump. So a battery is nice and simple, and it's also typically a lower price item than rooftop solar or a heat pump. So I think that will be the second thing that a lot of consumers will get. I would expect solar probably to then be the third thing, and together with the solar diverter, so you can heat your hot water from your solar, would go in at that same time. Now, heat pumps in the UK have been a real problem, and when you look at the road to net zero for the UK, the area that is most significantly behind is heat pump adoption. That's driven by a number of factors. It's firstly expensive to put a heat pump in. Secondly, because of the spark gap, the difference between the electricity price and gas price, it is not automatically cheaper to heat your home with a heat pump than it is with gas. And thirdly, the time that most people replace the gas boiler is when it breaks, and you can get a gas boiler installed next day. You cannot get a heat pump installed next day. So the heat pump industry really needs to think about how does it address that distressed purchase point, which is when most people think about, I need to change my heating system. I'm not sure, to be honest, what the government's answer is going to be about increasing the number of heat pumps installed across the UK. I'm not sure there is an immediate short-term policy answer to that. And so I think within the kind of timeframes that you asked about, I would still expect a significant proportion of houses not to have a heat pump and to still be operating on gas heating, but to have all of the other assets, to have the solar, to have the battery, and to have the EV charger. And then all of that will be coordinated in some way, because otherwise it's just too difficult. So there will be a home energy management system that will make all of that work together. And because of the way the government is going around energy smart appliances and the smart and secure energy system, they will also be flexing those assets under control from the grid. And so the vast majority of households will be participating in the flexibility market in some shape or form, and probably seeing a financial benefit from that as well, which will help to offset their electricity bills. So you'll get a nation of people who are much more engaged in the energy system and in self-generation and also participating in flexibility.
That does sound borderline utopian, to be fair. Tell me, Andrew, quickly, in terms of perhaps Europe and Australia, do you think there are perhaps lessons to be learned or shared? Is there a region or a country that, in your experience, because obviously my energy is kind of all over, that you think, okay, this is really working, perhaps would be a good blueprint?
Yeah, so I think some really, really good things that the UK has done, actually. I think the flexibility market is probably one of the most innovative that we see across the countries we operate in. It's relatively straightforward for aggregators to work in that market and to put flexible assets into the system. And it's relatively easy for the payments to flow through the process to give a benefit back to the consumer. I think the Australian example is really interesting around the incentivization on battery storage. And that's definitely something that we would like to see the UK government doing, because I think it really is a win for the consumer. It's a win for the grid. It's a win for everybody if you have more batteries going into the system. And if we look at the European markets, again, they're mixed. You know, Germany, where we have quite a big business, for various policy-related reasons, has not rolled out that many smart meters. So it's much more difficult to have a flexibility market or to have smart tariffs if you haven't got smart meters in the country. So they are, in some respects, a bit further behind on the home electrification, but probably further ahead in terms of adoption of electric vehicles. So, yeah, all markets are different. Some of that comes about because of the policies that the governments took in the early days. And some of it comes about just because of sentiment in those countries and willingness to experiment and to adopt.
Andrew, in terms of your role at MyEnergy, what is your mission? And I'm not talking about MyEnergy's mission, your personal mission. And what is it that not only do you want to achieve, but what drives you? I mean, obviously, you have a clear understanding of what consumers need and you want to meet that need. So I would assume that does form part of it. And, you know, based on the Genesis story that you shared at the beginning, you know, it's a case of, well, we see a problem, let's create a solution. Is that part of it as well?
Yeah, so I suppose, you know, what motivates me is, there's several different levels to it, I guess. So firstly, I joined the business in January 2025. At that point, I was really motivated to join because of that Genesis story from Lee and Jordan and the vision that they had created. And I could see in MyEnergy a company that had been around for 9 years at that point and was really ready to take that next step into really scaling up the growth of the business and really supporting consumers to realize the benefits that they could get from all of these electrification assets that they could put into their homes. So that was really what motivated me to join. I then obviously met the wider group outside just Lee and Jordan, and I could see they were all passionate and driven people who really wanted to make MyEnergy a great business, make it a great place to work, and to help consumers to realize those benefits. And in terms of so me and what I want to do with the business, well, we just recently had our 10-year anniversary celebrations, and Lee had originally spoken about the fact he wanted to create a 100-year company, not just obviously a 10-year company. I like to think that I'm sort of at the start of the 90 years after his 10 years of first starting it out. It's really about trying to create a business that that has that longevity and that can last for at least 100 years, hopefully longer. And I think we're just at such a super exciting time in the electrification journey, because it's still quite early. There's still policy changes happening every week. There's different things like flexibility markets to be participating in. There's consumer education to do. There's just so many different angles to this industry that it feels like we've only been started to scratch the surface. And I'm just really excited to see how far we can take it and where it will go.
Andrew, thank you so, so much for joining me. It has been a pleasure to chat with you and just to get an understanding of the landscape and how consumer behavior is really changing with electrification. So thank you for joining me.
That's been great. Thank you very much.
And thank you to our listeners. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Energy Transitions Podcast, brought to you by Enlit and Friends. That's a wrap from me, Pamela Larg, and our producer, Rian Mostert. We hope you can join us next time. Visit enlit.world or subscribe for more episodes.